You've landed inside Launch Street, the Business Innovation Podcast, where we interview top innovators out there shaking things up so you can innovate, differentiate, and get further faster. Since you're here, we know you're the type of person that recognizes the importance of unlocking your innovation advantage so you can compete and win. And now, your host, the person that has worked with leading companies like Disney, Procter & Gamble, Arrow Electronics, the U.S. Army Research Labs, and Red Robin on upping their innovation advantage, Tamara Gontor.
What's up, Launch Street? Tamara here, your host and innovation enabler. I have a great guest for you today. You've probably heard of her by one of her best-selling books, How to Market to People Not Like You, Crafting the Customer Experience for People Not Like You, and her latest is How to Work With and Lead People Not Like You. I bet you're getting the theme here. It's the incredible Kelly McDonald. Now, I wanted to have her on the show because one of the things that I believe and have experienced over my years is that one of the most important aspects to get to innovation is diversity in thinking. And all too often, it's, you know, those of us birds of a feather together looking in the same box, in the same way, looking at the same data from the same perspective, and then wondering why this magical innovation genie doesn't come out. Kelly, as you can tell, is all about how to interact in all these different ways with people not like you. That is diversity in thinking. And that, my friends, leads to innovation. Now, you will hear in our interview that Kelly is most definitely an inquisitive risk taker. You can hear it in her stories, in how she thinks about her work, how she gathers data, how she relays it. The inquisitive side is all about innovation in the questions, not the answers. Now, I have the good fortune of knowing Kelly. I've known her for many years now, actually, and she may be one of the most inquisitive people I know. She's constantly asking questions, but she uses that to get to the deeper layers. And when you're dealing and managing and leading and interacting with people not like you, having that ability to dig and dig helps you not only connect, but bring out that creativity in the people around you. Now, the risk taker, and you'll totally hear it on this interview, Kelly's all about being uncomfortable, pushing the boundaries, going out there to the edges where really there's so much innovation. Part of being a risk taker is being willing to think and say the things that other people aren't willing. It might be you out there if you're that person in the meeting where everybody's going in one direction and you decide to go into the other and kind of raise your hand like, I'm not sure I agree, even though all 10 of you are headed this way. That's exactly Kelly. And I absolutely love her approach to diversity in thinking because it's not just the hypotheticals. It's not just the big platitudes. We hear that all the time, don't we? We all buy into it. Kelly really digs into, that's the inquisitive side, by the way, how it really works, how you can actually do it in a way that works for you and works for the people around you to actually build the business. All right, let me give you a little bit of intro beside the three best-selling books I mentioned in the beginning. She is considered one of the nation's top experts in marketing, customer service, and consumer trends. Kelly McDonald's clients range from Toyota to Subaru, Kimberly-Clark, Nike, Harley-Davidson, MillerCoors, Sherwin-Williams. Yeah, a few names you've probably heard. Kelly was named one of the 10 most booked speakers in the U.S. She was also number one on the list of 26 hot speakers by Successful Meetings magazine. She's been featured on CNBC, in Forbes, Bloomberg, Businessweek, Fast Company, on CNN Money, and more. Kelly has this incredible interview with us. I can't wait to dig into it. So what do you say we do that? Let's do this.
Kelly, thank you so much for joining me. This is going to be fantastic.
Thanks, Tamara. Thanks for having me.
All right. Since you're new to the audience, what's the one thing people would be surprised to learn about you?
It's a really weird, dorky thing, but I'm from Wisconsin. And one of the things that's really big in Wisconsin in the summers is water skiing shows. Oh. And I was part of a water skiing show from the age of 12 to 18. We put on two shows a week. And at first I was a skier and we would do pyramids and water ballet and all that kind of stuff. Yeah. No, I mean like real shows. And then after a while, and you'll get a kick out of this tomorrow because you know what a talker I am. When I was about 16 years old, they said, we'd really rather actually have you MC this thing rather than ski.
They're like, I think your talents lie elsewhere.
I was a good skier, but I was apparently a better talker.
Oh my God, that is fantastic. Which is so funny because I've known you now for a while and I did not know that.
I mean, I'm not, it's just one of those dorky things. And it's like, I live in Denver now and it's like people who aren't from the Midwest don't even know what a water ski show is. But, you know, we'd have like 200 people that would come to the show and we did it twice a week. And, you know, we'd ski for 2 hours and we would just, like I said, do these amazing acrobats and you know, athletic stuff on skis.
So I have to ask before we move on, is the pyramid hard?
You know what? It's actually not that hard. It's one of those things that looks like it's really hard. And it's once you learn how to do it on water, it's actually not that hard. The hardest part is bringing them down because the people who have climbed up on the shoulders of the people below, then when they climb down, they have no skis because they kicked them off, obviously. Right. So you have to have two people skiing on a set of skis. But it's really actually quite easy.
Oh my gosh, you just blew my mind. I could have a whole conversation about this, but that's not why I wanted to have you on the show. So we'll move on. So you wrote a book, How to Work With and Lead People Not Like You, and you have a long history in business, as I talked about in the intro, and a lot of work in this area in particular. So let's start with kind of the big high level question and then dig in. Why is diversity in thinking so important to innovation?
Tamara, I think it's actually the bedrock of innovation. I think it's the very definition, or if not, it should be, because that's where innovation starts. Innovation starts with someone thinking differently about something, more in a different way than it's ever been thought of before. And that's where all invention, innovation, concepts start. And so if you have people who all have the same experiences, they think the same way, they like to do things the same way, that's not an innovative culture. And, you know, there's a famous YouTube video that has some assignment that they gave like engineers. These are guys who are like super brainiac engineers, and they gave them something like 5 straws, like plastic straws to like build something with. And they literally, I mean, these are like incredibly smart engineers. They couldn't do it. Yeah. And then they gave them to like 3-year-olds and they did it in like 2 seconds because, you know, 3-year-olds are like, oh, like, we can do anything here. There's nothing that's out of the norm. And so, diversity of thought and diversity of experience and all that that implies, all of the background that you bring, every way that you think about things, all of that is what shapes the way that you solve problems and move the business forward. And that to me is the very, like I said, bedrock of innovation.
So let me ask you a question on that. So I 100% agree with you. I mean, I think you and I were talking in one of our prior conversations about ideas that come from birds of a feather tend to die, right? They've got holes in them. They're not strong enough. They're really not innovative because we're all looking in the same box, in the same way, at the same data, from the same perspective. You need that diversity. When you're inside a company, how do you think about getting that diversity? And I'm asking not just from a hiring perspective, but more from a, how do I leverage that to make sure it's actually happening? Because I think it's what I think you've said to me, it's like great in theory, but hard in practice.
Oh, it's totally hard in practice. That's one of the reasons this is such a hot topic right now, is because companies have invested so heavily in having a diverse workforce. So they went out and got a bunch of diverse people, whether it's diverse backgrounds, diverse languages, diverse experience, you know, different cultures, whatever. And then they throw them all together and can't figure out why it's not gelling. And so, you know, that's good. Step one is diverse talent. But step two is you have to work to pull these people together and to make them see that it's okay if everybody doesn't see the same thing the same way. So one simple exercise that I can share with your listeners, and I experienced this firsthand At a company that I worked for, a large global ad agency that I worked for years ago. And there were about 60 of us on the team that worked on this one particular account. And we kind of knew each other from sight. Some of us knew each other quite well. There were other people who are, I was like, I don't even know who that is. And my boss pulled all of us together for a 45 minute meeting one day. And he said, we're not going to talk about business. We're going to talk about each other. And he said, there's 60 people here, and I don't even know if you all know each other. And he said, I want everybody in the room to go around the table, you know, around the room and share something with the rest of the team that people are not likely to know. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, you have to make this a safe experiment for something. You can't say, tell us about your felony arrest.
Right. Tell us about your drug addiction back in the day.
Right. But it was fascinating because here were all these people, some of whom I knew only by sight, some of whom I actually interacted with. And it was fascinating what people would share, like what I just shared with you about the water skiing thing and things that don't ever come up at work. And consequently, there was a guy that in the accounting department that I knew, and he shared that he and his wife were in the process of adopting a little baby girl.
Oh.
And it was like, oh, and that was kind of cool. But here's what was really cool. What was really cool is it changed the way that I saw that guy, because no longer did I just see him as a capable accountant. I then saw him as a doting dad as well. And it gave me a chance to talk to him about other things. But I mean, that's a silly example because that one doesn't have anything to do with business. But what happens is when people find out something interesting about another person that they didn't know, it fosters better conversations overall, because then you can springboard off of that and go, I didn't know you like fly fishing, Tamara, or I didn't know you were born in New York. You know, my cousin's from New York, whatever. And it fosters the coming together, because at the end of the day, people are people. And we actually do want that common ground, even though we might be coming from different places. Does that make sense?
It totally does. And one of the things that I'm just kind of sitting here percolating on as you're talking is it sounds like part of what you're saying with this kind of really tapping into that diversity in your workforce isn't just the superficial level of diversity that we all think, which is important, right? Whether
right.
that's kind of, you know, gender, minor ethnicity,
race,
right? The things that we all
language,
age,
yeah.
right? The things we always think about, but actually going much deeper into what are the different perspectives, experiences, focuses
right.
that person has that they can bring to the table. Is that fair
and
to say?
And then in this case, imagine 60 people who are hearing all the same information the same way at the same time. So all of a sudden we're hearing like 60 different little anecdotes about each other. You don't think that some of that's going to come back into play at work? I mean, like we're going to be, you know, down the road in a meeting a couple weeks later and somebody's going to go, you know, Tamara is the person that we should talk to about that because she is the one who said blah, blah, blah. And I know she's got some experience with, I mean, you just never know. And I guess what I thought was so impressive about it, it was a meeting that didn't cost a dime. And it was a simple way for my boss to bring those people together who wouldn't otherwise necessarily be together at all. We would be siloed and, you know, Joe's in accounting and Kelly's in account service and so-and-so's in graphic design or whatever. And it's like all of a sudden we had something cool that bonded us that was not just the piece of business we worked on.
So will you share, because I've heard them for you, and I know you share a lot of these great stories from the stage, too, because you do a lot of keynoting, some stories of working with people gone wrong. It's a horrible way to ask it, but, you know, it's so easy to identify the big gone wrongs, but I think there's a lot of subtle things that if we knew to shift, we'd be able to tap into that diversity even better.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, I don't know how much time you have. If this could take 6 or 8 hours to talk about things gone wrong. I mean, there's so many stories. One, I think that is a great brand experience that ultimately has a happy ending, but I can share this with your listeners is Skinny Girl cocktails. Here's the quick story on Skinny Girl. So Bethany Frankel, had this concept that women might really enjoy having a good tasting, low calorie cocktail. So she just had a concept. And so she went and she pitched every single major liquor company in the United States, this concept, every single one of them. And every single one turned her down.
Wow.
And she went ahead and forged ahead and found some venture capital and all that stuff and built the brand. 2 years later, after selling 400 million cases of Skinny Girl, Beam, as in Jim Beam, bought her company back from her. So that was a good move. They took it, you know, they declined the opportunity at first, and 2 years later, when obviously she had a
it was proven at that point. They said, "Oh, we'll take that." Yeah.
But they bought it back for $100 million, the same brand that they took a pass on, you know, just a couple of years before that they could have gotten for a song. So what happened there? Well, what I surmise that happened is the facts of the matter are that women metabolize calories differently than men. It's just harder for
us. It's why I can't eat pint of ice cream at night and still lose weight.
I think men, you know, it's not that they can just gorge out or anything like that, but it really is easier for men. It's just we metabolize calories differently than men do. It's harder for us, and that's a fact. And so I believe what happened is she was in pitching to groups of men about this concept of the low-calorie cocktails, and the men were not being dismissive or disparaging. I think they literally couldn't understand what the big idea was. I don't know if this is actually, like, that great. And I think if there had been some women around the table, that those women would have been like, hold up, are you kidding?
Yeah, this is it. You
know? Yeah, and so that is a classic case of they missed something big. Now, the good news is they had a chance to get it back. They bought it back, you know, the brand back 2 years later. But only after they'd missed out on the first 400 million cases of product. And I believe that, again, what they missed out on was just they didn't think like the consumer thing.
So is this a matter then, Kelly, of recognizing that, you know, I've got some unconscious bias and I may not be understanding the power or the brilliance in their idea because I don't come from their perspective. And even because I would venture to say, right, that those – to build on your story, those men in the room probably weren't sitting back and going, huh, oh, wait a minute, I don't have her perspective, let me listen. They probably just were looking at the business case, it didn't resonate with them, and they moved on.
Right. They're kind of like, I don't know if this is a good product or not. I mean, I completely agree with you, and I think that's exactly what happened. And I think, you know, maybe the ideal world would have been to have a more diverse group around the table. But if the decision makers weren't diverse, if they were in fact all men, the next best move would have been, you know what? I don't really count calories like this. I'm not the target market for this. Let me go get some women in the office and see if they can weigh in on this. You know, I mean, like, because it's a product for women. Obviously, anybody can drink it. But it was her concept was that women would like to have a good tasting cosmopolitan and not blow their daily calories. And so, I think that's exactly it. I think it's they applied their own bias. I hate that word bias, but their own perspective, if you will. Yeah, their own perspective. They were just sort of like, I don't know. It sounds okay, but will anybody really buy this?
Well, and it makes me wonder, and for launch readers out there listening, to really think about how many times you're working with people not like you who are coming from different perspective and shutting down their opinion or idea because you don't understand where they come from or why, and not taking that moment to say, hey, am I not agreeing with this because I don't understand their perspective, or is there something else going on here?
And it's certainly that, Tamara. It's not anybody ever saying, I don't care about your opinion.
Sure.
I'm just going to do things my way. We're oblivious. And that's why having people around who can gently challenge that and say, you know, there's another way to look at this. And I have a graphic in my presentations that I do that's pretty powerful that has the numerals 606. But if you were to write that on a piece of paper and then put that piece of paper in front of two people on two sides of a table, somebody sees 606 and somebody sees 909. They can actually be looking at the exact same thing and see things differently. And I think that's the other thing that people need to understand is two people or 10 people or 20 people can look at the same thing and see something different.
Which I think, to go back to innovation, right? That's the power of innovation, is when you have all these people looking at the same thing, but differently.
Exactly. It's a positive thing because they're seeing possibilities. Somebody might be saying, oh, it's brown. And someone else said, that's not brown. That's kind of a light pinky, you know, whatever. Or it's just different. And different is good. And I think as long as we can foster those conversations, then businesses are going to do better when it comes to, have we explored all sides of something?
Do you think that businesses are a little bit like cities, meaning I feel like there are a lot of cities out there that seem diverse if you looked at their population stats. But if you actually go to, right. If you go to the city, right, like some people live over here, they're all birds of a feather. These birds of a feather live over here. Is that happening in organizations? Is that diversity getting siloed?
Of course. Think about, okay, this is going to be extremely generalist, okay, stereotypical. Yeah. Think about the people in the legal department of a large company versus the people in sales versus the people in IT. Like, you can start to kind of go, okay, all the IT people are going to be the same. They're going to be really cerebral. They're going to be really good problem solvers. That's how they are. And sure, that's true, but there's still differences there. But in, somebody in sales is more like, ready, fire, aim. They just want to go sell something. They don't want to sit in meetings all day or whatever. So absolutely. I mean, every organization has these departments or you know, groups of people who are absolutely siloed because they're surrounded by people that get them. I mean, we all like that. There's nothing bad about, I want your listeners to understand this. If you feel like when you're working with diverse people, it's hard, you're not crazy and you're not doing it wrong. It is hard. That's why people don't do it. We are drawn to the things that are comfortable and familiar. And consequently, we have to literally make ourselves pursue conversations, relationships, friendships, et cetera, with people who think differently because it is uncomfortable. It can be.
Well, and I think that that's part of the challenge, right, is being willing to be uncomfortable. And would you say that part of that is also a little bit putting yourself out on a ledge? Because I'll just speak personally and say that you know me for a while now. I'm a really open person to different people and perspectives. And sometimes I'm worried that I'm going to say the wrong thing.
Okay, so let's talk about that. We're all worried that we're going to say the wrong thing, especially now in the climate and culture that we're in. It really has consequences. I mean, you say the wrong thing to the wrong person in the wrong way, and your job could be at risk, or your company could get sued for $70 million. But here's what I want to say is, people are going to say the wrong thing. We're humans. And it's not because we have poor intent. We're not trying to be hurtful. We're not trying to be disrespectful. Sometimes it's out of thoughtlessness, carelessness, speed, right? We're like speaking too fast or something like that. Sometimes it's even out of ignorance. And here's a great story. I can tell you two quick ones about this. And I think it's something that your listeners can really relate to because we're all going to do it. A friend of mine, her name is Amber. She's black and she is a young woman, young black woman in Kansas City. And she's an attorney and she had to go do a deposition. She could go to the other attorney's office or they could come to hers. And so she said, I'll go to the other attorney's office. And she had to go to Salina, Kansas, which is a very rural, small and white town. So there's not just a lot of young, successful black women attorneys in Salina. I'm actually betting that there's none or very few. So she goes to this attorney's office and she walks in. And as she describes the story, she says, you know, the woman behind the reception desk is like 110 years old. Okay. So yeah, she's just,
we've all been to that office.
We've all been to that office. Right. And Amber walks in and says, hi, I'm Amber Fitzgerald. I'm here for the deposition. And the woman said, oh, well, you can just sit over there and wait for your attorney.
Oh.
She thought she was the defendant, not the attorney. No, wait, there's more.
No.
So then Amber says, no, I'm sorry. I'm Amber Fitzgerald. I'm with Fitzgerald, Simmons, and Fitzpatrick, the attorney. And then the woman said, oh, I didn't know they let paralegals do depositions.
Oh, my goodness.
Right. So she insulted her twice. First on like, okay, you can't possibly be the attorney. You must be a clerical person. And then, you know, you also must be the defendant. So I'm like losing my mind. And I'm like, oh my God, what did you do? I would have given her a piece of my mind. That's racist, sexist, and ageist.
Right.
Yeah. And I said, I was just like, I was dying. And she said, you know, Kelly, I could have done that. I could have gotten in her face and shook my finger at her and lectured her. And she said, but she's like 110. And she said, consider her framework. When she started working, women were not even in the workforce. And if they were, they were clerical. So I believe she didn't actually mean any malice. She literally just said the first thing that came to her mind, which is, oh, I didn't know that paralegals, you know? And so I said, oh my gosh, okay, you're a better person than I am, Amber. What did you do? And Amber said, I reached into my business, my purse. I pulled out my business card and I gave it to her with a big smile. And I said, I'm Amber Fitzgerald. I'm with Fitzgerald, Simmons and Fitzpatrick. I'm the attorney for the defendant. And I am a little early, so I'm just going to sit right over here and wait for my client. And she said the woman knew exactly what she had said, and she was horrified. But the point is, assume goodwill. You know, like yeah. People are going to screw up. And then one other quick story. There's a global company that everyone who is listening to this knows, so they shall remain nameless. Yeah. And they were telling me that every time somebody says something wrong of their company, they get sued for $50 million. And they were very appreciative of the fact that I was talking about how sometimes people say the wrong thing. We're just, you're going to do it. I'm going to do it. We don't mean to, we just do. And they told me a story about how they were having a meeting with engineers, and not to be, you know, again, stereotypical, but a lot of engineers, I guess, they're big alpha, you know, their coin of trade is how smart they are, how smart they are. And so there's a whole room full of these engineers and they're kind of peacocking for each other. You know, if they're all super brainiac and they're smart and they're peacocking. And one guy had a suggestion and he threw out an idea for something. And another one of the engineers said, that's the most retarded idea I've ever heard.
Oh,
right. Now, you know, and I know that he doesn't mean to mock mentally disabled people, but that's what he said.
No, and if you grew up in the 80s, that was unfortunately common language.
Exactly. And so my point is, I'm not excusing him, and they didn't excuse him, but he's probably not even aware that he's even saying that, and he's certainly not aware of how it's landing. He's probably been saying that all his life. And again, it's not an excuse. So I was talking to my client. I said, oh my gosh, what did you do? And they said, well, we pulled him aside, and we said, you know, Ned, I don't know if you're aware of this, but here's what you said at the meeting and here's why it's unacceptable. And he was mortified. Once again, he was mortified, but it just came out. And so, you know, I feel like we can take up swords or we can just assume goodwill. Now, obviously, if somebody says something very blatantly racist, sexist, you know, homophobic, whatever, I mean, that's different. But we all step in dog do from time to time. And I think it's just, you know, like just armor down a little bit once in a while and realize that somebody may not have had the intent that you think. And I think that we can talk about that. I mean, if somebody says something offensive, then you can say, I don't know if you're aware of how that landed, but let me tell you how that struck me. Can we talk about that?
Well, and I venture to say, and I love your perspective on this, that this constant barriers up or guard up is actually hindering our ability to do business. And again, to your point, yeah. I'm not saying that we shouldn't address the people who are blatant. I'm not saying that, but to be able to leverage and dig into and really get value out of those other perspectives around the table, we're all going to have to come to the middle a little bit.
Well, and I mean, here's completely agree. And here's another one. A friend of mine was telling me she's single, and that shouldn't even be relevant, but it's part of the story. She's single and she was seeing a guy, and then she's pregnant, and somebody at work said to her, oh my gosh, you got pregnant. Just like that, you got pregnant. And she looked at her and she said, no, I'm having a baby. And I was like, wow, there's a difference between you got pregnant, which sounds really judgy and sort of like something you did to yourself, versus no, I'm having a baby. And so again, you know, I think we can all just, I want to take very seriously the things that are wrong, but every once in a while, somebody just says something the wrong way. Like I said, you're going to do it. I'm going to do it. We do it. So, and we have a choice about how to react.
So you had told me over sushi one night that a client had said to you, and I hope you don't mind that I bring this in, but everything you're saying really gets to this point of, they said something to the effect of, I know what not to do, but I don't know what to do. Because it seems like we spend a lot of time, and I'm not talking about you and I in this podcast, I'm just saying in general in leadership and in companies, we spend a lot of time focusing on, here's what's off limits. Here's the tree that you shouldn't hit while you snowboard. Forget about all that open space. So what should we be doing instead?
Yeah, you're right. The exact words that this guy said to me is, he said, I know how to be wrong. What I don't know is how to be right. And I was really struck by that. So he's gotten all the training about, you know, you can't say this, you can't say that. One of the things that I think is really, really helpful is to learn how to disagree respectfully with, again, out getting in trouble. And the very word disagree makes people armor up, Tamara. They literally, like, you know, we say, oh, we should agree to disagree. And that sounds like conceptually that should be fine. But what happens is people switch into persuasion mode. And then I'm like, oh, you disagree with me? Well, clearly I haven't done a good job of convincing you of the validity of my side of this argument, whatever, you know? So I have a better way. What I teach people is when you're faced with someone that you disagree with, or you, frankly, you don't even have to disagree. Maybe you don't understand. You don't understand their perspective. You have no idea how they can be looking at this and thinking about it that way. To just simply say, I see it differently. Because I see it differently is not combative. It's not antagonistic. You're not even trying to persuade someone. It's certainly not superior or anything. It's a simple declarative statement. I see it differently. And if you were to say to me tomorrow, Kelly, I see it differently, chances are I'm going to say, well, tell me how you see it. And then we're going to have a conversation and not a debate. And I think that is a huge, huge, simple forward tactic that anybody can apply in trying to learn how to be right. To your point about the guy that said, you know, I know how to be wrong. I don't know how to be right. One way that you be right is to say, let's talk about this tomorrow. I see it differently. Tell me how you see it. Because the more you talk about something, the more you can actually find that common ground, or at least have the information now about why your colleague, your client, your vendor, your supplier, your coworker, whatever, sees something differently than you do.
You know, I love it. We have this whole thing over Launch Street about constructive conflict, which in essence is the same kind of concept of you can have debate. And in fact, debate is great for business and innovation because it elevates everything, actually, because otherwise you're just stuck with your one perspective. And kind of that's a whole thing in itself. But I think agree to disagree is like, I'm going to dig my heels in and you're going to dig yours in. That's what that says. Yeah.
It really is. It's one of those loaded words that shouldn't be loaded, but it has become that way. And it's just psychologically, we all sort of, rather than saying, oh, well, tell me why you disagree with me and having a constructive conversation. You're right. We do dig in. And so I try not to use that word disagree. I just approach it from, I see it differently. Or I can, if that's not forthcoming, I can say, you know, tomorrow I can tell that you see this differently. Tell me how you see it. I want to understand. And so we're not trying to persuade at that point or, you know, show that I'm superior or that I'm right and that you're an idiot or that I'm just truly seeking to understand. Just tell me how you see it. Clearly, I don't see it the same way, but I might be missing something here.
Well, and I think that's the key there, right? I might be missing something and being open to that. And again, for business, that makes your thinking stronger. So why wouldn't you want someone else to poke holes or see it differently and build your idea or build your thinking? And Kelly, tell me if I'm wrong here, but my experience has been that when you get to the why, like tell me why you see it this way or where you're coming from or whatever, that's when you as the listener become way more open to what they're saying, number one. And number two, you start to see the value in their perspective is when you get to the why. That why part is so important.
So I agree with you, but I would actually take that why word and tweak it a little bit because this is just my perspective. I could be completely wrong, but in my experience, I find that even if you ask, tell me why you think that, people feel judged, like people feel defensive. They immediately feel defensive and they have to like justify why they think that. I substitute the word how, and I say, tell me how you see it.
Right.
Because how is far more like nebulous and all encompassing as opposed to tell me why you think that tomorrow. I mean, there's like, you know what I'm saying? Like, depending on how that why is delivered, tell me why you think that. It can sound really patronizing. It can make somebody feel defensive. And frankly, they might struggle to explain why they feel that way or why they see something that way. But usually people can explain how they see it.
That's such a great nuance too. I'm glad you brought that up. I was just laughing because it reminded me of all my years in market research. We'd never ask why. We'd avoid the word why. I hadn't really thought about that in years, but you're absolutely right. And I think that also allows you to debate the idea at hand versus the person. And because that's where I think we get into trouble.
Because if I say, why do you think that? Then immediately
it's about
you
me.
Feel like you have to defend your own thoughts, your own opinions and stuff like that. And if I just say, tell me how you see this. And you might say, well, sales is never going to go for this because of blah, blah, blah. I mean, all of a sudden it's much more abstract. It's not personal.
Right. No, that's a great, for launch readers out there, use how, not why. And I think getting to that place really opens up the conversation. And as I was just saying, makes it about debating or having conflict, whatever word you want to use, around the solution, the idea, the topic versus the person.
There's one more thing on that too, is I think, say to someone, tell me why you think that, or tell me why you feel that way. It can sound judgy, dismissive, and like you're superior. And if you say how, it to me feels more like you're giving that person respect. Like, Tamara, tell me how you see this. Like, I actually want to know. I value your opinion, and I know you might be seeing it differently. Tell me how you see it. I feel like that is literally giving them like respect or flattery or honor. Maybe it's honor is the word. Whereas why, tell me why you see it like that, sounds just the opposite to me.
Yeah. No, I don't think you're wrong. And like I said, I hadn't thought about it in years. And I'm just reflecting back to the last conversation I was in where someone said to me, well, why? And I remember being like, because I said so. Like that was what I wanted to say. Like it actually put up my defenses. And I didn't in the moment realize it's because they used the word why. And they weren't actually being judgmental. They just, that's the word that they use. I think that for launch readers listening, that is an important detail. And I would try to switch my language today at work and see how it's what you're saying is received differently.
Yeah. Yeah. So that'll be $10,000, please, tomorrow.
Yeah. Exactly.
So that little piece of advice.
That's right. That's a gold nugget right there. I'm curious from your book, How to Work With and Lead People Not Like You. And again, we'll put the link in the show notes and all that. You know, a lot of people have read it. They've heard you speak on it and talk about the concepts. What's kind of the one thing in there that you've gotten feedback on that readers, it really resonates with them? And maybe you didn't think it would, or maybe you just didn't realize that was the nugget that would be so powerful.
The one piece that they all, I can see it in their faces when I speak, and then I've had people write to me, email me or whatever, is they want to know that they're not bad people because they're struggling to work with someone they don't understand. And I think, again, our culture, and I'm all about diversity. I'm all about, you know, we are the world and all that. But I do feel that what's happened is people feel like, man, if I'm struggling to understand or work with this person and I just don't get them, I don't get their approach, I don't get the way they work, I don't get the way they think, this is hard. They don't feel like they can say anything. Their job could be at risk. And so then they not only are struggling and they keep quiet, but they feel like they're doing something wrong. They feel like they're racist or sexist or homophobic or Islamophobic or xenophobic. They feel like they're a bad person. And one of the things that I try to assure them is hanging out and surrounding yourself with people who are like you is human nature. It literally is human nature. And so it doesn't make you bad if it makes you uncomfortable when you're confronted with someone who's different. It makes you normal. And that is like, you can just almost see this like sigh of relief where people are like, oh, thank God, I was trying so hard to be a good person, but I really am struggling to work with Tamara. She just doesn't think the same way that I do. And so I have one little anecdote actually that I can share with you on that.
Yeah.
And that is to put some science behind this, because, you know, we can talk about the kumbaya all day long, but business is about metrics and business is about what works. And so there were psychologists and social psychologists who wanted to study whether when people were confronted with someone who is different from them, how that how that worked with problem solving and you know, solving a problem. And they wanted to take race and ethnicity and things like that off the table because it just gets sticky. And they wanted to find another way that they could compare like people to unlike people. So what they used was groups of fraternity brothers and sorority sisters. And for any of your listeners who have ever been involved in a fraternity or sorority, there's a strong sense of affiliation. You know, this is my group, right? This is my group. These are my people. And so they gave groups of three, sorority sisters, fraternity brothers, a murder mystery to solve. And they gave them clues and they each had 20 minutes to solve this murder mystery. But 5 minutes into the exercise, certain groups were joined by a fourth fraternity brother or sorority sister, but from a different house.
Huh.
So in other words, they were the other, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So your listeners have it. They're the other. And what happened is, as you would imagine, is completely predictable, is the groups that had the outsider, if you will, solve the murder mystery better, faster, more accurately, significantly better, more than double their chances.
Wow.
That's predictable, but that's not, to me, the interesting part.
Yeah.
The interesting part was when asked afterwards, how did that feel? You won. Hey, Tamara, your group won. Congratulations. How did that feel? You guys nailed it on the murder mystery. The groups that had the outsider were like completely mystified and exhausted. They were like, we won. Oh my God. No, they were like, we won. Oh my God. We didn't feel like we were winning. All we did was bicker. That did not feel good. I couldn't even believe that we were actually accomplishing anything because none of us saw eye to eye. Oh my God, that was awful. And so the bottom line is working with diverse people feels harder because it is harder. You're not crazy. If you're working with people who are different than you and it's a struggle, you're not crazy and you're not doing it wrong. It's freaking hard. And so understand that and let yourself feel that difficulty and realize I'm okay. I just have to power through. There's no shortcut here. I just have to do it. The result is always going to be amazing, even though it felt awful. There was a guy that came up to me after I was speaking on this one day and he goes, you know that thing about the sorority and fraternity? I said, yeah. He goes, it's kind of like exercise. And I said, what do you mean? And he goes, it's easier to stay on the couch and watch TV. And he said, I have to make myself go for a run. I don't really want to. I have to make myself go for a run. I have to put in that effort. But if I do, I always feel better afterwards. The result is always worth it. But we're not naturally inclined to do that. We're naturally inclined to not do that. And I think that's an important takeaway.
What I appreciate about what you're saying, Kelly, is if it's hard, doesn't mean it's wrong. In fact, it probably means
it doesn't
right.
mean that you're a bad person and that you're, if you know, I mean, it doesn't mean you're bad. It means you're different from the other person. And that's why this is hard, because you don't understand where they're coming from. I mean, go back to the Jim Beam thing. They just didn't understand what the big deal was with a low calorie drink. What's the big deal?
I mean, I think if you went back to a lot of investor pitches, I would venture to say that that's probably a lot of the cases of, you know, the conference table missing the opportunities because they didn't see that perspective. I'll give you a short kind of story back, Kelly. I have a mentor who's a advertising teacher over at CU Boulder, and he used to be CMO of Coors, Kellogg's, P&G, like incredible marketing history. And his name is Bill. And he came to me super frustrated because his students, who are very much birds of a feather, right, who go to CU Boulder and take this advertising undergraduate class, couldn't fathom why somebody would shop at Walmart. Because obviously, you should shop at Whole Foods.
The best retailer in the world.
Totally, right? Now, like, for listeners out there who don't know Colorado the way Kelly and I do, Boulder is a bubble. It is a bubble of wealth and privilege.
It's very precious.
Yes, it's a lot of electric cars and a lot of money. I mean, really. And it's a great place. I love it. It's beautiful.
There's a lot of money. Yeah.
It's Boulder. So his kids that go to that school tend to come from that environment. He was really frustrated because he's in an advertising class where the whole point to your book and your work is to market to people not like you. That's a lot of what our work is at the end of the day, is selling and marketing and leading people, right? As you know, who are not like us. So we're sitting over lunch and I said, well, what if you did this? What if you made a class project where they had to go to a Walmart and then they had to talk to people about why they had what they had in their shopping carts?
Awesome.
Yeah. So he started doing this and these kids would go and they'd go to Walmart and Kelly, their minds were blown.
They were like walking into a foreign country where they don't speak the language.
And they're taught. And one of them was telling this story in the class when they did their presentation about talking to this mom who has, you know, the big bag of frozen, you know, burritos and the big bag of frozen waffles. And, you know, each of them are a dollar. And her saying that she's got six mouths to feed and she can't afford the vegetables, and just the eye opening that happened by stepping into somebody else's shoes as much as they could, like finally changed the game for some of these students because they just didn't understand.
They couldn't understand,
yeah, why you would come from that other
perspective. Why wouldn't you just go to Whole Foods?
Right. Well, there's a reason it's called Whole Paycheck, people. Like, come on. So, I mean, but it was fascinating to see the transformation of these students when they realized, wow, there are people out there who aren't like us. Because from their perspective, they didn't even get that.
Sure. They're never, because they never come into contact with people who are different than they are.
Right. Right.
So that's not even in their sphere. They're not working with or going to school with or talking to anybody who's different than they.
And I think kind of going back to all the stuff you've been talking about, it really is about how do you open your eyes and first just have that recognition that there's other people in this world not like us and that they have something important to bring to the table. And if we start there, everything changes. In our kind of final time, let's dig into the ROI of diversity because we've kind of hinted at it throughout and talked a lot about kind of what to do as a leader inside companies. Can you share a story or an example of someone out there who has done it, who has come up with something brilliant or whatever that business case is, but recognizing that it comes from a place of diverse thinking?
I got one. It's so weird. Are you ready? This is like,
you know, I love weird.
This is like one of the weirder things, but it's brilliant. So funeral homes,
obviously.
Yeah, funeral homes are in a unique situation because you can't make people die, right?
You can't
demand for your product. You can only be top of mind when someone does die, right?
Right.
So funeral homes have a lot of things all in common, though. They have usually beautiful landscape grounds. They have chapels, all this kind of stuff. And there was a funeral home, I think it was in Tennessee, that was struggling with business being down because guess what? People are choosing cremation more and more than a traditional burial. So their business was going down. And even though they do cremations, there's not as much money in that. It's not as profitable. And so they were struggling. Their revenue was down. And they were like, how could we build revenue? Again, you can't make people die. So someone suggested to them that with the grounds that they have and the chapel that they have, that they should host weddings. Because literally other than...
Because they're empty most of the time.
Correct. And other than getting a bar, they had everything. They have the chapel, they have the beautiful landscape grounds or whatever. And brides often struggle with trying to find a location they can afford that is also available.
100% true.
If everybody wants to get married between, you know, April and July, then there's only so many venues that are available and all that. And so they tried it and it worked. And it wouldn't necessarily be right for everybody. There's going to be people who are going to say, I'm not going to do that. But there were enough people who were like, you know what? Once you drive past the gates of this particular, you know, funeral home, it's just like a venue. I mean, there's a pavilion there. Yeah. I mean, I just thought that was, and that came from someone who thought about it differently. It came from a young woman who worked there who said, why couldn't we do weddings?
My gosh. First of all, I would have never thought you would have taken the story to funeral homes, but I absolutely love it. And, you know, I think one of my favorite stories to share from the stage is Dollar Shave Club, because who would have thought that you could sell razors for a subscription? Some guy who wasn't in the razor business did. And sometimes I think diversity of thinking is simply connecting with people outside your day-to-day world. You know, we get so myopic in our work, and then we talk to people who are as deep in it as we are.
Right. And then in the case of this funeral home, the funeral director was certainly not somebody who's getting married. You know, he was in his like 50s or 60s, and he had this woman who was working for him, and she was new, and she was in her 20s. And when you're in your 20s, all of your friends are getting married. And so all you do when you go out for drinks with your friends is listen to their frustrations about their wedding and how they can't find a venue and blah, blah, blah. And so she just threw it out there. And what I credit him with is being
listening.
Open. Yeah. Yes. Being open enough to say, that sounds a little weird, but we should try it, as opposed to that's a ridiculous idea, you know? And so, yeah.
I mean,
I think that's the coolest thing.
I feel like we all just need to take a pause for a moment because it's such a crazy story, but it's a great example. And, you know, there's two things I think for leaders out there, Kelly, that I've heard you say. There are many others, but two big ones that stand out to me. One is ask how did you come to that perspective?
How do you see it?
Right. And the other one is being open to listening and hearing and really doing something with those ideas that come from people from different perspectives, stages, backgrounds, et cetera. Because I think the reason that worked, to your point, is because she was in that phase of life, not in the other phase of life.
Correct. Correct. And I mean, it really is one of the more refreshing, unusual, you know, business case stories I've ever heard about. But I give her credit for coming up with the idea. I give him credit for saying, all right, that's a little out there, but what have we got to lose? Let's try it, you know? And I think that that's the culture that we all want to get to is like, let's not dismiss what on the surface might strike us as odd, bizarre, weird, or if you want to go totally old school, well, we've always done it this way, right? I mean, like, my gosh, you know, it's like, well, okay, you can continue to keep doing that, but you're going to find your business is shrinking.
So I'm going to go back for a second to, do you remember that Pepsi ad with one of the Jenners, Kardashians? I never remember which one's which.
Yes.
Yeah, it was one of them. Anyway, right, where she, it's the whole protest movement and it got super slammed.
And she hands the cop a Pepsi.
And all is right in the world. So
that's all it took.
Right. That's all it takes is a Pepsi. Who knew? Like, we've been doing it wrong in the Middle East this whole time.
Peace.
Who knew? So, and I, the reason I want to bring that up is I'm just going to go back for a second. Sorry, Pepsi, but you've done this so many times. Many, many years ago when I was in my 20s, I was working in brand strategy and innovation. We, you know, we would meet, Pepsi was one of our clients, and I was very junior on the team at the time, but we'd meet with them. And it was, we were all, the conversation was always about how do we capture youth? How do we capture youth? How do we get the younger generation? And around the table were always people over 50. Right. And it always blew my mind that, those were the people, and all of the same birds of a feather, 100%, right? At that time in particular, now I'm not saying, I'm not part of Pepsi's hiring practices now, so I don't know who they have now. This was back in the 90s, but it was all the same people. And then, and their efforts always failed because it was birds of a feather and not part of the market they were even trying to talk to. And then so to fast forward to that ad, my first thought was, wow, that was a birds of a feather around the conference table making a bad decision and and not realizing what they did.
And not realizing it until it was too late. And then think about how costly that is.
Yeah.
Not only from a humiliation standpoint, they got, you know, they got just taken apart on social media, but all the money that they expended creating that, and then they shelved it, you know, as they should have. But I mean, yeah, it's not only a bad idea, it was a very costly one.
Yeah, costly on a lot of levels. And to what you said earlier, I firmly believe those people were not being mean. They just didn't see it.
Oblivious.
Yeah. So I think that's all to say that the ROI on having people around you not like you is there, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, that's the very nature of innovation, is just diversity of thought. It really is. It's not about the color of your skin or the shape of your eyes or how old you are or what gender. And it's about perspective. Diversity of perspective is really what we're talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. Before I ask you the last question, where can people go to learn more or connect with you?
Oh, sure. My website. It's www.mcdonaldmarketing.com.
Can I just tell people out there that they should get on your newsletter? So I think I told you this the other day. Kelly's one of the few newsletters I actually subscribe to. Most I unsubscribe because it makes me smarter. So if you're out there, you're welcome. If you're out there in business, I highly recommend getting onto her newsletter and mine, obviously. But I think Kelly and I both come from the same perspective of what value can I bring to you? So your newsletters always have great articles and points of business that I just don't have the time to go gather. So
thank you.
We try to
highlight three consumer trends in every newsletter. And so it's really short. It's not a bunch of articles. It's just three. And they all highlight a macro consumer trend that people need to pay attention to. And we do get a lot of feedback on that, tomorrow. People say every month, you know, when they get the newsletter, I get emails from people who say yours is the only one I read. Thank you so much. Cause
yeah,
it's a real fast and easy read. So thanks for the plug.
Well, it's fast and easy and it makes me smarter. So then I get to go to my meeting and say, did you know? So
right.
I love it for that. So you're welcome. Cause I, like I said, I actually read it.
Thank you.
Yeah. So my last question for you is, and really thinking about the leaders inside organizations that are trying to tackle this from a team perspective of what's your advice for them looking to kind of improve their business results through that diversity of thinking by actually, you know, leveraging the talent that I would gather most of us now have around us. We just don't know what to do.
Yeah. I think the number one piece of advice that I would offer is lead by example. And that is to start the conversation. Don't expect the conversation to just happen without help. In the case of my boss that brought us all together and said, you know, I want everybody to share something about themselves that the others won't know. That was a fostered conversation. That conversation would never have happened on its own, ever. And by doing that, he not only got us all talking and sharing, but he led by example by showing us the value of that. We were using those little anecdotes about each other for years afterwards. And we all knew something, it bonded us. So I think that's one of those things that doesn't cost any money. It takes a little bit of time, but pull your team together for 45 minutes someday and say, we're not going to talk about the business right now. We're just going to talk about each other and get some of that stuff out on the table. You'd be surprised, first of all, how many interesting things you'll learn about your own people. And then number two is you'll be amazed at the common ground that's there with people that you wouldn't have thought have common ground.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the reasons, Tamara, you and I go to a lot of conferences and we have to mingle with people who we're never going to see again. And I've always found it interesting that, like at a cocktail party when you're schmoozing or networking, the first things that people will always ask is, do you have kids? If that doesn't work, in my case, it doesn't work. And then they'll go to, where do you live?
Right.
Or often for men, not to be sexist, but this is just my observation, sports.
Yeah.
And what I find in that is what people are really doing is they're trying to find common ground. That's what we want. We all want the same things. We want to find out, what can I talk to you about? You know? And if you can foster that as a leader and lead by example and foster the conversations that will make your own diverse team see each other and go, huh, oh, you're a dad too? Yeah. Or, oh my gosh, you grew up in a small town too? Me too. You know, I mean, that's what bonds people. And those conversations are not just going to happen.
Yeah, it's interesting. One of my favorite things to ask is like, what's your favorite hobby when you're not working? Because that always gets me to beyond the kids and places are great. It's a starting point for sure.
Right.
But I think probably like you, I can talk to anybody about anything because I'm always looking for that commonality. And I think kind of in what you're saying, launch readers really pay attention to that point of commonality is actually can be the bridge to diverse thinking. Because when you have that together, you're more open to that expansive side of the thinking as well. And I think the other thing too is, you know, in innovation in particular, and when you're trying to do things differently, which we have to do in today's marketplace, you can't solve yesterday's challenges and expect to be successful anymore. Mm-hmm. You need trust and vulnerability to get, because you have to put yourself out there to come up with those new ideas, test those new ideas, fail. Like you have to be willing to do that. You have to feel safe. And that exercise your boss took you through also adds a level of kind of vulnerability and trust that may or may not have been there before, certainly isn't for other people.
And companies spend a fortune on these team building exercises and retreats and all this kind of stuff. And here was a 45-minute meeting where we learned more about each other than any other opportunity I can think of. And it cost nothing. It cost nothing.
Well, here's all just to tell you this. And then we probably should at some point stop talking. Although clearly, as you learned early in your skiing days, that's what you should be doing. That's part of the reason why I opened this podcast with a personal question.
Mm-hmm.
Because I want to create a connection with not just me, but with our audience and create a level of openness with my guests before we get down to business.
I completely agree. It's so much more interesting to find out that little weird little nugget about somebody rather than just, oh, I have an MBA in this and I do this. And, you know, I mean, yeah, I mean, that stuff's important, but that's not what is sort of fascinating about somebody and interesting. And so I appreciate that you did that. Yeah.
Well, Kelly, this has been fantastic. Obviously, we're going to have you back when you have your next book out or do something amazing, which is probably in like 2 weeks. So
thank you, Tamara. This has been fun. It's always fun to talk to you.
I know. That was way longer than most of my interviews, but man, so many good insights. It was hard for me to stop asking her questions. It was so good. I'm sure, like me, you walked away with many tactics that you can do immediately. And I would encourage you to do so. There's such great content in here. Oh my gosh, so good. Now, if some of the way kind of Kelly spoke or some of the stories she shared, her approach resonated with you, you might actually be an inquisitive risk taker as well. If you have this deep desire to say, but wait, one more question, but hold on, what if we look at this differently? You could be an inquisitive like Kelly. You may have that ability to challenge assumptions and pull back the layers to find that innovation deep within. And if her kind of a willingness to be on the edge or be uncomfortable or kind of say those hard things spoke to you, you might be a risk taker. You might be that person willing to push the boundaries and leap and figure it out. People who are risk takers like Kelly actually innovate in those uncomfortable spaces. They're actually more comfortable being uncomfortable. I know, because that's one of my triggers as well. My other one is experiential, but we'll get that to another time. So if that inquisitive risk taker spoke to you and you're thinking, oh, that might be me, I highly encourage you to go to our website, go to launchstreet.com and take the assessment. Now there's two levels to it. One is a free level and you'll get one of your two power triggers. And if you purchase it and invest in yourself, you'll get your entire unique innovator archetype. And I will tell you, understanding that combination of your two power triggers, how you innovate the best, and your dormant trigger, the place that you want to avoid, make sure you don't get trapped in, that's where the magic happens. All right. I'll see you soon, everybody. Tamara, out.
Thanks for hanging with us on Inside Launch Street. If you know someone that is truly ready to unlock their innovation advantage, have them join you on Launch Street. Discover your innovation advantage. Build a team of high-performing innovators and ignite ideas and solutions that create massive impact. GOTO, LaunchStreet.com. Remember, innovators, if you don't take the leap, somebody else will.